It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. They're becoming as popular and common as zombie movies. Halloween pop-up shops. They feed off the corpses of dead big box stores and invade the empty spaces in your local shopping mall. They sell costumes, props, fake blood, and more to the masses. We're going to learn how they came to be, what makes them tick, and how the demise of a growing number of big box retailers is advantageous to their business. Do you live near a Halloween pop-up shop that used to be a big box retail store? Do you appreciate them filling space that would otherwise be sitting vacant? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Taylor Telford is a reporter covering national and breaking news at the Washington Post. She recently wrote the article, Why Halloween Pop-Ups Suddenly Possess So Many Dead Retail Spaces. Taylor, welcome to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
In the lead-up to today, Halloween, and even after, we often see Halloween pop-up stores taking spots that once housed big-box retailers like Toys R Us or Circuit City. Taylor, how long have Halloween pop-up shops been around?
So the first one was opened by the man who eventually opened Spencer's in 1983. He actually originally owned a women's clothing store and decided to toss in like some Batman masks and some fake blood. And he had a huge success with that in the early 80s and started operating a few more pop-up stores. But they didn't really become popular and have a lot of other competitive chains until the mid and late 90s.
So there are actual chains of these pop-up shops? What are some of the main ones?
So Spirit Halloween is by far the biggest. This year, there are actually more than 1,325 Spirit stores in the U.S., and they have a seasonal workforce of about 20,000 people, which is pretty impressive since that's actually, for the time being, larger than say, the number of JCPenney's in the U.S.
Wow.
And then Party City owns and operates their own version, which is called Halloween City, in addition to kind of focusing all of their seasonal merchandise on Halloween for the fall. They have about 250 stores this year, and they, too, hire about 20,000 seasonal employees to staff their regular Party City stores, the new Toy City pop-ups, and their Halloween City pop-ups. And then there are some local chains, like Ricky's in New York is a seasonal Halloween store. And then there's Halloween Express, which is based out of Owington, Kentucky, that has around, I think, 120 or 150 stores this year.
Holy cow, that's a lot. And for a store that's only open for a few months out of the year, well, they must be profitable or they wouldn't do it. How profitable are these businesses?
You know, it's hard to say because most of them are privately owned, and so they don't have to disclose their revenues or their profits. But given the consistent growth every year, all of these companies have opened more and more stores. I know Spirit is up 5% from last year. It's a pretty fair shake that they are probably making a good amount of money from the business that they do in really only about 2 to 3 months.
So what's behind the rise of these shops? Why are they so successful?
Well, the way that Americans celebrate Halloween, and specifically the amount of money that we're willing to drop on it, has really, really skyrocketed over the past, like, decade or so. The National Retail Federation does a survey every year where they log Halloween spending, and this year and last year were both record years at $9 billion spent on Halloween. And in particular, the growth is actually most related to money spent on adults. Originally, Halloween was very much a kid's holiday, and trick-or-treating actually started post-World War II when people started moving out to the suburbs, because as you can imagine, the suburbs are the ideal atmosphere for trick-or-treating in a safe environment. But adult costumes and pet costumes have been the areas that have seen the largest growth, and that really started skyrocketing actually with the advent of social media in the mid-2000s, because it's a holiday where people want to show off and they want to be out in public and goofing around with their friends. And so pet costumes have actually doubled in the last 8 years to $480 million spent on it this year. And adult costumes haven't had as drastic a jump just in the last few years, but right now most of those Halloween stores that we were talking about, about half of their inventory is geared toward adults. So it's a pretty safe bet that part of the reason these stores are able to flourish like they are is because we're spending more money on Halloween, and in particular, millennials are the highest spenders in all the categories, in candy, in decorations, in greeting cards, in costumes. They're the ones that are spending the most.
So let's talk about the business model for these stores. How do they select their locations?
So all of their operations are pretty condensed. It happens over a pretty short time frame. They start hunting for their real estate sometime around, like, summer. So some start as early as May or June. And sometimes, depending on how tough the real estate market is, they're scrambling to find spots until August, when some of them actually open up shop in August. So it's a pretty quick turnaround. And the thing with these stores is that they can afford to be pretty not picky about where they end up because they're a destination. So whereas a regular retailer would be worried about having a good location in a mall or having good roadside traffic or being able to attract random foot traffic, these stores will take the ends and elbows of a strip mall. They will be buried deep inside a mall because they can count on the fact that people are going to seek them out for what they have.
So these has the rise of online shopping affected these stories in any way, or is this just a business of we're procrastinating what we're going to do for Halloween and we're happy something's open so we can go buy whatever it is we think we need?
These stores definitely thrive off people's procrastination. Most of the chains that I spoke with said that they do the bulk of their business in the last 2 weeks before Halloween. And actually, a lot of them capture the business that they do precisely because of the flaws in online shopping. It's hard to gamble on a costume when you don't know how it's going to fit. And just the flood of online orders, sometimes it's not particularly reliable. And I had a store owner tell me that if you think that you can place an order like 2 or 3 days before Halloween and get it in time, you're probably not going to be able to do that because of just how much people are spending on Halloween now. So these stores can pretty much count on the fact that desperate people will come crawling in the week before Halloween and will find them wherever they are. So they can really be a little more flexible. They're pretty bulletproof when it comes to the amount of business they're going to do, regardless of the competition with online shopping.
How do these pop-up stores affect the way year-round party and costume stores operate?
Well, I actually spent a lot of time in one of those year-round stores, and to keep up with those stores, he actually had to change the name of his store seasonally, so it's almost like he's operating a pop-up shop within his own permanent store. They're normally called Total Party, and they switched to Total Fright because he learned that if he wanted to capture that Halloween market, he had to advertise that they were a specialty Halloween store. And they actually carry Halloween costumes year-round, but he wasn't having the success without changing the name to signal that. So they definitely have to gear all of their merchandising and their advertising around competing with these stores. Otherwise, they won't be able to keep up because people are going to go where they think the Halloween stuff is, which typically is one of these Halloween stores that has it in the name.
So are we going to see Zombies R Us show up next year, do you think?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Taylor Telford, thank you for letting us know about this new marketing and shopping phenomenon. Appreciate your time this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Taylor Telford, reporter covering national and breaking news at the Washington Post, who wrote the article, Why Halloween Pop-Ups Suddenly Possess So Many Dead Retail Spaces. The Halloween metaphors are just about endless. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The long-awaited Milwaukee streetcar is finally here. This Friday, the Hop will open to the public, who can take it from the train station to the Lower East Side and back again. We take a look at the project and how it relates to urban revitalization, transportation equity, and gentrification. in the city of Milwaukee. What do you think about this new streetcar? Is it a good investment, or does something about the project give you pause? What do you think about the areas that it covers? Too small, just right, too big? Are you excited to ride in the Milwaukee streetcar? What makes you want to experience this unique mode of transportation? Maybe you plan to stay far away from it. Either way, tell us why. Perhaps you live in another community and you want to go and visit Milwaukee and try out the streetcar. Tell us about that. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ivy Hu is chair of the department and a professor at the University of Wisconsin Milwaukee School of Architecture and Urban Planning. She joins us from our WPR studios in Milwaukee. Ivy, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you, John. It's nice to be here.
Tell us about the Milwaukee streetcar. What does the streetcar car look like? What kind of vehicle is this, and how does it run?
It's on a 2.5 mile stretch, and the streetcar now has two routes. One is circling around in the downtown area and has a small spur to the lakefront. And you can think of the train as a very big bus or a very long truck. And it's a very modern building. It has the hub symbol on the car, so it's going to be interesting to ride it.
And it runs on electricity over tracks?
Yes, it runs on electricity over the track.
People in Wisconsin may still be familiar with streetcars, those who are old enough, and I guess I would have to count myself as one of those. Others may have encountered trolleys in some cities. What's the difference between what we think of as streetcars or trolleys and what the hop is in Milwaukee?
I think technology-wise, there is no much difference, and it runs on the fixed track. It has a very small space in between the stops, so you can hop on and hop off, going to different destinations very easily. To my understanding, it's just the name, trolley or streetcar. It basically means technology-wise the same thing. Of course, we have newer, cleaner technology for sure now.
But this isn't my grandfather's streetcar. They were bumpy and noisy and uncomfortable. Tell us about these modern streetcars. What are they like inside?
It's going to be very quiet, and the ride is going to be very smooth. I haven't tried out, and I'm going to try out our hub this coming weekend. But when I ride other streetcars across the country, they are very comfortable, and you can see the streetscaping. You can see people walking by. It's going to be very pleasant.
And how many people can ride on these at one time?
A few hundred, but we are, as transportation professionals, we are talking about daily rideship, and the expected daily rideship is around 2,000 a day.
So now that we understand what it looks like and how it works, let's talk about the primary purpose of the Milwaukee streetcar. Why does it exist?
Oh, well, we've been talking about streetcar or a rail transit system for a long time. So the funding, actually the federal funding came to Milwaukee in the 1991. So when the IST, the multiple-year federal funding, federal law was passed during that time. And the law was to encourage multimodal safe transportation system for all people. So along with other larger metropolitan areas like Los Angeles, like DC, Milwaukee also get a big chunk of federal funds to support a expansive transit system in Milwaukee. But over the time, the city didn't have the matching fund, and the discussion of a rail system, rail transit system, has been going on for years until 2015. So that was when the time that the Common Council of Milwaukee approved the current scope of the streetcar. That's the streetcar we see today with the 2.5 mile stretch.
So is part of the reason for this thing to exist to attract tourism, to get people to come to downtown Milwaukee, something else? What's the goal here?
I guess the larger goal is economic development. So the goal is slightly different from almost 30 years ago, at that time, we were talking about transportation support, transportation access to jobs, to opportunities. Right now, I think the goal is more on improve the image of Milwaukee and serving right now with the 2.5 mile distance, serving the downtown business residents, and for sure, tourists and visitors to downtown can enjoy the convenient ride, the convenient service provided by the streetcar.
So, for our listeners who aren't in Milwaukee, give us some background. This has been in the works since the early 90s, and what finally tipped the scales and made this thing a reality?
I think it's the perception and acceptance of transit services. For years, there is a perception transit, and there is a perception that rail transit is going to be super expensive and it's going to be costly for the residents, and they serve higher income people, those people living in downtown and connecting to suburbs. Over the years, we realized that we cannot rely on private automobiles. The streets are getting congested. The air quality is getting worsened with the emission from the cars. So residents in Milwaukee, it seems to me, are more and more acceptable to environmental friendly, convenient transit services. And we know that transit is not as perceived as slow, efficient, and transit is more convenient and serving different residents and give very convenient services or access to a lot of different opportunities. So I think Milwaukee residents are accepting a new mode or a new phase of transit. I just want to bring up, like, in addition to the streetcar, Milwaukee is also seeking grants to build the first bus rapid transit system in Milwaukee. So we're talking about a lot of different modes of transit now.
Ivy Hu is chair of the department and a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Architecture and Urban Planning. We're talking about the new Milwaukee streetcar, the Hop. You can hop on the Hop this starting this Friday. They're opening it up to the public, and you can check that out if you're in Milwaukee. The streetcar in Milwaukee moves on city streets. The official website details that it goes between 25 and 30 miles per hour and stops every 3 to 4 blocks. What are some safety concerns people raise with a streetcar sharing the street with buses and cars?
We've seen some small accidents already. The main reason is that people haven't got used to a big train on the street and it's mixed traffic. I guess the only thing we can do is just be aware of streetcar. Just know that it's a big train, or imagine it's a big track. Do not stop suddenly in front of the train. Do not turn right in front of the train. Those are the things that, like, we need to consider when we are aware there is a big train riding next to us.
And what about people, pedestrians or bicyclists? How are officials making sure that they aren't in danger?
There are a lot of new pavements and new design features to make sure that people are aware that the train is coming and pedestrians can cross the street safely, watching out for the train. And frankly, when people get used to the streetcar and when people get used to the mixed traffic, it's going to be safer for pedestrians and bicyclists if the streetcar can reduce automobile traffic on the streets. We've seen a lot of successful examples across the country when the streets are more open to transit, reduce the traffic of private automobiles, that encourage people walking, biking on the streets. That's going to increase the safety.
And speaking of bicycles, some bicycle riders aren't happy with the trolley or with the streetcar because their tires have gotten wedged in the streetcar tracks. Have we seen other complaints already?
Yeah, we've seen complaints about bicyclists get their tires in the track. And people are also worried about how to get their bikes on and off the train, but that's going to be sorted out very easily. And the bicyclists probably can also consider, if they're really worried about their tires, they can consider alternative routes. So instead of using the street with the streetcar track, they can go to the next block. And we also have, the bike tracks around the station areas and helping people to transfer from bicycle into the new streetcar.
Professor Ivahoo stays with us talking about the Milwaukee streetcar. What do you think about the streetcar? Is the hop a good investment or not? What do you think about the areas that it covers? Do you think it's too small an area, or is it just right? Are you excited to ride the hop in Milwaukee? What makes you want to experience this unique mode of transportation? Or maybe you plan to stay as far away from it as you can. Well, either way, tell us why. Maybe you live in a community that has a streetcar. What are the advantages you see, and what are the challenges you encounter? You can hop on the radio with us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address, and you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The much-ballyhooed Milwaukee streetcar, the Hop, opens to the public this Friday, and we're wondering what you think of this project. Perhaps you live in another community that has a streetcar. Talk about what that's been like in your community. What are the challenges? What are the advantages? Tell us your story. Have you seen the Milwaukee streetcar or its tracks? What's your first impression? Would you travel to Wisconsin's largest city to take a ride on it? Do you think leaders are spending the right amount of money on a streetcar in Milwaukee, or is it maybe not a valid use of funding in your view? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ivy Hu is our guest. She is a chair of the department and a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Architecture and Urban Planning. Ivy, we have a lot of questions. One of them comes from a caller. Let's go to Jeremy in Racine. Jeremy, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I got a several questions. What did it cost to build this two-mile stretch of light rail in downtown Milwaukee, and what is the annual cost to maintain it? And then the other question is, what was the census outside of the immediate downtown area on the construction of this project? Most people I speak with that live in Milwaukee are not too fond of it. It really serves them no purpose, and they feel that they have a lot more pressing needs that need to be taken care of as far as infrastructure, law enforcement, fire prevention, all that stuff in Milwaukee that was more important to them than in this stretch of railroad.
Jeremy, thanks for those questions. Let's try and take them one at a time. First of all, how much did this project actually cost?
The expected cost is close to $130 million, and the actual cost right now is reaching $100 million. But we have to understand that more than half of the funding actually comes from the federal government. So as I was explaining, in 1990s, we actually got hundreds of millions of dollars from the federal grants, and we still have $55 million left from that time, and we use it on the streetcar. Additionally, the state of Milwaukee also acquired around $15 million from a new federal grant that's also used to support the construction and the purchasing the vehicle for the current two-mile stretch.
And what will it cost? What will the annual operating cost of this of the hop be?
It's going to be $3.5 million. We talked about the fare. The fare can be paid to recover some of the operating cost. But if we consider the daily riders, 2,000, then we probably can recover 700,000 the fare, so sort of 20% of the operating cost. But I want to emphasize that it's very common practice. Transit is subsidized across the country, and the 20 to 30% fare box recovery rate is about the average across the country.
Is this streetcar coming at the expense of other mass transit projects, such as expanding bus lines or even light rail?
I don't see it in that way. I see the streetcar is a small piece in a large transit system, which includes transit, which includes MCTS system, Milwaukee County Transit Services system. And we also can consider the streetcar serves other purposes for people who drive to downtown. And they can park in one location, then get to a lot of different destinations downtown area without driving or without walking in the cold weather. So the streetcar can be a supplement for the transit system and can be a supplement for other people who drive or take bus to come into downtown. Then they can easily explore downtown area.
The Jeremy's other point, and this is something that other people have brought up, is that Milwaukee had a lot of needs, and people wonder why they spent the money on the HOP instead of putting it into, say, law enforcement or the school system or some other need. Considering the source of the funding, could they have actually done that? I mean, is that a valid criticism?
I see the point and I understand the concern. First, a large part of the funding, including the capital cost, as we were seeing, close to $100 million now, and a large part of the operating cost, although it's $3.5 million every year, most of them are provided or are funded by the federal government. So we got the funding to do that. And the small part of the capital cost and the operating cost will come from the fare and will come from the TIF. It's tax incremental financing, the system in the city of Milwaukee. The expectation is that the streetcar can improve the property value and it can increase the attractiveness of the downtown. A lot of people want to enjoy urban life and the streetcar can potentially provide that atmosphere, that amenities for people to see Milwaukee City as a revived, as a very lively city. In that sense, again, streetcar is a tool to improve the economy and potentially bring a lot of tax dollars money into the city, which can be used later on to a lot of needed areas, education, law enforcement, et cetera, et cetera.
So how is the streetcar affecting property values in Milwaukee?
Well, I heard that property price is going up right now along the station areas, and there is new development on the lakeshore and connecting to the streetcar system as well. So people are expecting, business owners and potential riders are excited about this.
One issue that gets brought up at times like this is the issue of gentrification, the idea of wealthier people moving into less wealthy neighborhoods, renovating the area and driving out poorer residents who can't afford to live there anymore. Could this streetcar contribute to gentrification in Milwaukee?
It could potentially, and right now we're talking about the downtown area. So the extent of the further gentrification property is limited. But we're also talking about the expansion of the streetcar system. So potentially it could be expanded north on the Martin Luther King Drive. So it will go through, once we get the funding, it will go through the inner city black neighborhoods. And it can potentially extend south from the Third Ward into Walker's Point. And Walker's Point is already started to see gentrification. So yes, I see the concern that gentrification might displace current residents, but it can also bring in benefits like improve the property value, bring in business into these neighborhoods. Again, we need to look at gentrification from both sides.
Let's take another call here. Charlie is with us from Milwaukee. Charlie, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, one, why would we build a trolley system that might be hindered by the, you know, the weather? I mean, that I heard it will now work very well in, hello?
Yep, we're here. Go ahead.
I heard that it was.
I think we lost Charlie. Bad cell. You're cutting in and out. The point, Charlie's point is, why would we build a system that's going to have trouble working in the wintertime when there's snow?
We are still trying to figure out the snow plowing, everything. But trolley or streetcar in cold weather is very common. And so there is going to be totally solution on that. I just visited Buffalo last week. So they also have a light rail system. There is no issue with, you know, operating a streetcar or light rail in cold weather.
Does you mentioned a possible expansion of the streetcar the streetcar system. Right now, does it go to the new Bucks Arena? And if not, is there a plan to send it there?
Yes, that's the discussion, and the city submitted grant application to the federal government. We haven't got the funding yet, so the city will keep trying. And for future expansion as well, we are seeking federal grants.
The Milwaukee streetcar gets electricity from an overhead wire. What do urban planners have to consider when implementing this kind of infrastructure?
Well, the utility is a surprise after the proposal was approved. But in urban planning, we consider more about equity, about economic development, about the ridership. So that's all part of the consideration. And I also hope that the streetcar can eventually extend it to UWM, where I work. And I'm sure a lot of faculty and students and staff would love to ride streetcar down to downtown area and explore the restaurants, the entertainment that Milwaukee City can offer us.
And how much does it cost to ride on the hop?
Right now, it's free. It's going to be free for a year. And after that, it's going to be $1 per ride.
$1 per ride. Wow, that sounds pretty reasonable. And what are people, what are you hearing? What are people saying about the streetcar right now versus other ways of getting around town?
People are expecting it. We want to try it out. And I also hear concerns like the previous caller saying, like, oh, well, it's downtown area. It's not helping us living in different areas of Milwaukee. And again, we need to think about streetcar as a small piece in a large transportation system. And again, by, you know, just 2 miles, probably it doesn't really increase people's transportation mobility or accessibility. But over time, once expanded, once it's incorporated into the large transit system or transportation system, we can see its potential benefits.
Ivy Hu, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, John.
Ivy Hu is chair of the department and professor at the University of Wisconsin Milwaukee School of Architecture and Urban Planning. She joined us from our Milwaukee studios. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. This election season, WPR is going beyond the ballot. Our team of reporters has been out in communities around the state to find out what people really care about. We've been meeting you where you are to see what's driving you to the polls this year. And we've been using what we've learned to guide our election coverage. What's the most important issue to you this election and why? Share with us by calling 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Do you feel like your elected representatives reflect you and the community you live in? What changes would you like to see? Maybe you can think of recent examples when government positively impacted your life or maybe made it more difficult. Tell us how. You can email us ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tell us what's going on in your community that you feel is overlooked. What issues or developments need more attention? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Wisconsin's next governor will set the agenda for state government, but how much he or she is able to accomplish will depend in large part on who controls the legislature. Republicans currently control both houses of the legislature, but Democrats would need to flip just two seats to win control of the state Senate. That's put a spotlight on a handful of competitive Senate races around Wisconsin. We'll hear reports on three of them this morning. The first is from Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Johnson.
Wisconsin's 17th state Senate district includes parts of nine counties in southwest Wisconsin. But even people who don't live there might have been hearing about the candidates on TV.
I'm Howard Markline. I'm proud to have kept my word to look after your tax dollars.
Money has flowed into this race, both from outside groups and the candidates. Spring Green Republican Senator Howard Markline's campaign alone has spent more than $800,000 this year. Markline's pitch to voters is about money.
They may not agree with me on every issue, but they know I'm watching the checkbook.
Markline was first elected to the Senate in 2014 and served 4 years in the state assembly before that. He's a certified public accountant and a member of the legislature's budget committee, where he helped identify more than $1 billion in financial reserves at the University of Wisconsin system. The legislature has frozen tuition for in-state students every year since.
I can tell you that every student at UW-Platteville today is saving $2,500 because of the work that I did finding that those cash balances back in 2013. We haven't had a tuition increase since that time.
Markline says he'd like to spend more on rural roads. And then when it comes to road funding, quote, everything is on the table, including possibly raising the gas tax. He voted to increase funding for schools last year, but won't promise it again next year until he sees the rest of the budget.
Hi, I'm Chris Marion.
Hi, I'm Brenda.
I'm running for state senate this year.
Okay.
Markline's opponent, Democrat Chris Marion, runs a small farm and a bed and breakfast in Blanchardville. She got to know state politics when she pushed for a law and then a lawsuit to allow for the sale of home-baked goods in Wisconsin. As she meets with voters in Monroe, Marion blames Markline for the poor state of roads.
Do you know anything about Markline?
Nope.
He's been in for 8 years, four budgets. He's on the Joint Finance Committee and the Transportation Committee, and I hold him responsible for these roads.
Marion says Markline hurt schools when he cut education funding in earlier budgets. She also faults him for supporting Wisconsin's Foxconn bill.
I mean, you can't knock on a door or sit next to someone at a bar or, you know, even stop to fill gas up in a van that says Chris Marion on it without somebody talking to you about Foxconn. It's incredibly unpopular out here.
Despite the Senate district's Republican lean, it's been competitive in other races. President Obama won here by 14 percentage points. Marion realizes a race like hers could decide the Senate. She says a balanced legislature would go a long way toward better discussions in state government. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Patty Murray. The race for the 19th state Senate district could affect control of state government, but a local issue has been front and center here, including at a recent forum.
Welcome to this candidates forum. It's co-sponsored.
The Fox Valley district is in papermaking country, or at least it used to be. Several mills have closed, and Kimberly Clark has said it may shut down its Cold Spring plant that employs 500 people. Appleton Republican State Senator Roger Roth sponsored a bill that would offer more than $100 million in state tax credits to the company to keep it open. Roth says the entire region would benefit.
It will be a boom for Northeast Wisconsin in every job up and down that supply chain.
But the bill went nowhere in the Senate. Roth's Democratic opponent, Lee Snodgrass of Appleton, blamed Roth for its failure, saying he should have involved both parties in finding a solution.
Certainly we don't want to see them leave, but it's difficult when we have a profitable corporation who we're offering tax incentives to.
Roth, the nephew of former U.S. Representative Toby Roth, says he'll try for a vote on the bill during an extraordinary session after the election. He says it's important to get the Kimberly-Clark deal right.
They've been part of this community for 150 years, and that's why it's so important that we do what we can to keep them here. You can recognize...
Snodgrass says she worked in a mill while in college. She's now a director of communications for the Girl Scouts in parts of Wisconsin and Michigan. She questioned why Roth didn't bring this bill up before the election.
We all could have had an answer last March. Right now, that has just left people hanging. So that uncertainty has already left a number of people to leave that facility.
Roth won his first race in 2014 by almost 15 percentage points, but there are reasons Democrats are competing here. President Trump won this district by just 7 points, and President Obama drew even here in his last election. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Patty Murray.
And I'm Ximena Condi. By most measures, Wisconsin's 5th State Senate district in southeast Wisconsin is a Republican stronghold. Mitt Romney won the district by double digits in 2012. So did Governor Scott Walker in 2014. But President Donald Trump's struggles with traditionally Republican suburban voters were evident here in 2016. Trump won this district by just 1 percentage point, giving Democrats a potential opening. At a recent forum between the candidates for this state Senate seat, most of the discussion focused on state issues.
Not every school that takes vouchers is bad, but the reality is that too many of them are.
That's Democrat Julie Henze of Wauwatosa. She's a corporate trainer, outdoor adventure coach, and political newcomer. Henze says there's a lack of accountability with the state's voucher program, and it shouldn't grow anymore until those issues are dealt with. Her opponent is Brookfield Republican State Representative Dale Coinga. He announced his campaign after current GOP State Senator Leah Vukmir launched her bid for U.S. Senate. Coinga is an Army reservist, a certified public accountant, and an outspoken advocate for school vouchers.
It's parents who expand school choice. It's not legislators.
There are hints of the national political debate at this forum. Coinga warns against too much government involvement in healthcare.
Universal healthcare is going to put nearly the entire population on Medicaid. We cannot afford that.
Coinga says the solution to rising healthcare costs is more flexibility with the Medicare program. Henze says universal healthcare could save people money in the long run.
Quality, affordable healthcare is a right, and we should have a healthcare system that meets our citizens' needs without placing the burden on employers.
The tone of national politics is also on the minds of voters at this forum. Mary McNulty lives in Waukesha and plans on voting for Coinga because of his experience. She says she's disheartened by how divided the country has become.
I'm scared about what's happening in that we want to throw everybody out for somebody new, and I then think that we're so much further off from getting ahead of where we are at this moment.
Milwaukee resident Elena Calhoun plans to vote for Henze. She says the election of Donald Trump made her more engaged.
The day after the inauguration, I took a bus to Washington, and I was at that women's march, and I haven't stopped since.
That's carried over into local races like the 5th State Senate District, one of a handful that could decide control over the Senate for the next 2 years. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Ximena Condi.
WPR reporter Sean Johnson, Patty Murray, and Ximena Condi brought to you that story as part of WPR's ongoing Beyond the Ballot series. We're telling stories from people all across Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you. You can be part of the Beyond the Ballot project. Just pick up the phone and call our hotline. Here's the number, 877-782-8942, 877-782-8942. You can also share with us at WPR.org/ballot, WPR.org/ballot. Again, that hotline number, 877-782-8942. And you can tune in to WPR Tuesday night, November 6th, for live election coverage. NPR reports on national races starting at 7 o'clock. When polls in Wisconsin close at 8, Sean Johnson, Frederica Freiberg, and Rob Ferret anchor WPR's coverage of statewide elections, including the races for governor and U.S. senator. We'll be there throughout the night with election results and analysis. That's live election night coverage starting at 7 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson.